Good morning. This is Dallas Townsend with a CBS World News Roundup. The temporary release from prison of Francis Crawford is expected today in Moscow, although a hitch has developed. Soviet authorities say they haven't completed the formalities yet. Crawford is the American businessman, a representative of International Harvester Corporation, who was arrested 2 weeks ago on charges of currency violations. Yesterday, in an unofficial quid pro quo, two Soviet UN employees accused of espionage in New Jersey were released to the custody of Soviet Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin. Crawford is to be turned over to the custody of the American ambassador in Moscow, Malcolm Toon. In an apparently unrelated development, two American correspondents, Craig Whitney of the New York Times and Harold Piper of the Baltimore Sun, have been ordered to appear in a Moscow court tomorrow on slander charges. This may be because of stories they wrote recently about the Soviet republics of Georgia and Armenia. Still another occurrence in Moscow this morning, a young Russian wielding an axe apparently went berserk, killed two elderly foreign tourists outside the Inn Tourist Hotel, and seriously injured a third. A federal court hearing will be held in New York today on an unusual question, whether or not Attorney General Griffin Bell should be held in contempt of court. Fred Graham in Washington tells us about it.
Never has a federal judge held an Attorney General of the United States in contempt of court, but Federal District Judge Thomas Grisey of Manhattan will conduct a hearing this afternoon to decide whether to do just that. The situation arose out of Judge Grisey's order to the Justice Department to turn over to the Socialist Workers Party in a civil case the files of 18 informers who once spied on the party for the FBI. Attorney General Griffin Bell has refused to turn over the informers' files, saying it would cripple the FBI's future operations and seeking higher court review of the issue. Justice Department lawyers will argue today that a contempt citation is not necessary, that Judge Grisey should just assess damages against the Justice Department for refusing, and let the government appeal that after the civil trial is over. The Socialist Workers Party will insist it needs the information during the trial, and that Bell should be forced to turn it over now, if necessary, by jailing him for contempt of court. Fred Graham, CBS News, Washington.
The Supreme Court yesterday upheld the constitutionality of the 1957 Price-Anderson Act, which puts a ceiling on the amount of damages that can be collected from a private nuclear power company as a result of a single nuclear accident. The limit now is $560 million, but it could increase to around $1 billion by 1985. The law was designed to encourage private investments in firms employing nuclear power. An industry spokesman calls the ruling a victory for common sense. Consumer advocate Ralph Nader says it opens the door for dozens of hazardous industries to seek the same sort of limit on compensation. Nuclear power today, says Nader, liquefied natural gas tomorrow. South Yemen, at the toe of the Arabian Peninsula, still has a Marxist government this morning. In fact, as we hear from Doug Tunnell in Beirut, it may be even more Marxist than it was until yesterday.
After a full day of fighting that ended with the execution of President Salim Rabai Ali, the government of the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen has announced that it has a new president. His name is Ali Nasser Mohammed, South Yemen's prime minister. President Mohammed's predecessor died in front of a firing squad last night, along with two other ranking members of the South Yemeni regime. The three men were charged with trying to seize dictatorial power in a military coup. According to reports, quoting diplomatic sources here, the former president ordered army units loyal to his regime to shell the headquarters of South Yemen's Moscow-backed ruling party, the National Front. Columns of troops were reportedly marching on the capital of Aden, and according to one report here, fighting between various army factions left the presidential palace in ruins. The fall of the Ali regime in South Yemen is generally considered here to be a victory for Marxist hardliners in the National Front. The deposed president was described in some reports in Beirut as a moderate, whose efforts to establish better relations with some of the more conservative regimes on the Arabian Peninsula turned his ruling party against him. Doug Tunnell, CBS News, Beirut.
The government of Israel today appears to be backtracking somewhat from Sunday's announcement, turning down the latest Egyptian proposals for getting the deadlocked peace talks going again. Bruno Wassertile reports from Tel Aviv.
Government sources here insist that Israel has not rejected an Egyptian peace plan, arguing that none has yet been presented. What was rejected, they say, were proposals attributed to President Sadat by Radio Cairo that called for preconditions to a renewal of negotiations. According to Radio Cairo, Sadat was demanding that Israel hand over the Gaza Strip to Egypt and the West Bank to Jordan prior to concluding peace arrangements. Officials here still say that everything is negotiable, but insist that peace talks be resumed with no strings attached. They maintain that Israel will consider any Egyptian peace plan whenever it's presented. So far, there has been no direct official comment here on President Carter's criticism yesterday of Israel's latest diplomatic moves toward Cairo and Washington. Bruno Wassertile for CBS News in Tel Aviv.
That criticism came in the course of Mr. Carter's news conference yesterday afternoon. The president said he was disappointed by the Israeli cabinet's most recent statement, and he declared the United States is determined to get Israel and Egypt to resume their peace talks despite their differences. British Prime Minister James Callaghan, here in New York last night, addressed a fundraising dinner for the Hubert Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs, and he became the first recipient of the Humphrey Award for International Statesmanship. Callaghan then sounded a theme that the late senator from Minnesota would certainly have approved. The world's wealthy nations, he said, must do much more than they're doing now to help the poor nations.
Offer a hungry peasant bread or democracy for his starving family, and which will he choose? He'll choose bread. And if our democratic values are to triumph, then we need, in the richer industrialized world, to embark upon an international program of sharing and partnership unmatched in history.
In line with that approach, Callaghan said the British government plans to write off almost $200 million in loans to poor countries, turning them into outright grants. The Senate last night approved a foreign aid authorization bill for fiscal year 1979, but it included a 5% across-the-board cut in the total, bringing it down from $1.83 billion to $1.76 billion. The vote for the amendment was 57 to 22. It was introduced by independent Senator Harry Byrd of Virginia. CBS News asked Byrd whether California's Proposition 13 had anything to do with the result.
I think more and more my colleagues are beginning to realize that that there's got to be some curtailment of this tremendous expansion of government, the tremendous increases all along the line. The people of California, when they voted, had their eyes on Washington and on the federal government as much as they did on the situation in California.
Senator Harry Byrd added that he's only trying to help President Carter fulfill his campaign promise to balance the budget by 1981. The UN General Assembly is now in the last days of its special session on disarmament. But as we hear from CBS News UN correspondent Richard C. Hontalet, a lot of work remains to be taken care of before the final gavel.
The Assembly has planned to adjourn Wednesday night, but its several working groups are still hammering away at the so-called final document that will sum up the accomplishment of this session. It will consist essentially of three elements: a declaration, a program of action, and an outline of the machinery for future disarmament negotiation. Most of the hard work has been in private, which is meant to facilitate diplomacy, but from all indications, the writing of the final document has been a battle over almost every paragraph. And many of the key points are still in brackets, that is to say, they are not yet agreed. The Assembly will in the end act by consensus and not by vote. This means that matters of controversy will have to be boiled down to a lower and lower common denominator, or, like the draft resolution calling for an arms embargo against Israel, simply put off to next fall. The next 36 to 48 hours will see the Assembly acting as a political pressure cooker. Richard C. Hottle at CBS News, United Nations.
The Commerce Department reports this morning that the nation's trade deficit dropped to the lowest level in 8 months during May, but still continued at the record pace of last year. It was the 24th monthly trade deficit in a row. Several thousand students went on a rampage last night in Matamoros, Mexico, across the Rio Grande from Brownsville, Texas. The city hall and 30 other buildings were set on fire, stores and banks were looted, and it took Mexican police and army troops almost 4 hours to restore order. At least two rioters are said to have been shot and killed by police resisting an attack on the jail.